Welcome to the seventh edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella, flying solo for the remainder of today's show. In First Down, I will be joined by ESPN Radio's own Mike Greenberg of the Mike and Mike in the Morning program, as well as SportsCenter, to discuss the state of the National Football League. We touch on, of course, Greeny's favorite New York Jets, the Dallas Cowboys, the New Orleans Saints, Philadelphia Eagles, to name some of the topics discussed. In Second Down, and through the rest of the show, I am solo to discuss all things Arizona State football and give you some of my thoughts about some of the big news in the sporting world. Without further ado, let's hop in to First Down. Into First Down now, I am joined by the world's foremost authority in all matters, ESPN radio personality, host of the Mike and Mike in the Morning program, Mike Greenberg. Mike, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, Mike, thanks for taking the time to come here. We brought Greeny on to discuss all things NFL and a little bit of the big news of the day. Let's first start with, I guess, the biggest news. Former Penn State president of the university, Graham Spanier, he's going to be charged with perjury, obstruction, among other things. Mike, what is your initial reaction to that incident?
Well, specifically to Graham Spanier being charged, it doesn't surprise me. I think it took longer than I expected, just based upon talking to most of the legal analysts that we have at ESPN and having read as much as I did about this, it seems almost impossible to me that the president of the university was not kept informed, certainly as much as Curley and Schultz were, of what was going on. So if you were going to charge the athletic director and the vice president, then I couldn't see how in the world it wouldn't ultimately get to the president. So that doesn't come as a surprise to me. As far as the incident in its entirety, obviously, It's an unspeakable tragedy, and it's something that goes well beyond sports. It is only peripherally, I guess, connected to sports, and it's probably in the 20 years that I've been covering sports, well, not probably, in the 20 years I've been covering sports, it's the most singularly horrendous story that we've ever seen. And you can get into all sorts of debates over whether it is really a cautionary tale or just an isolated incident. But one way or another, it is certainly a true tragedy. And I hope that we are getting close to closing the book on knowing everything there is to know, and whatever degree of closure there will ever be for the victims in this, getting to that. But my sense is that we aren't all that close to that, and there is still going to be a lot of things in this that come out before we can really close the book on it.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It is obviously a horrific and a tragic story, which goes well beyond that of sports. But I think it's good for some of these families to maybe get some closure, to make sure all the I's are dotted and the T's crossed. But like we said, everyone across the country wishes none of us had to deal with that. None of that had to happen. To transition for maybe a college topic, Steve Spurrier, the coach at South Carolina, the old ball coach as he's known, came out and said he thinks that Alabama could beat some NFL teams, which really, I guess, re-raises the debate last season some folks had about Kentucky maybe being able to beat these Charlotte Bobcats. Where do you weigh in on that? I think it would be very difficult for a collegiate team to beat a pro team anywhere, even if they had home field advantage. It would be difficult. What do you think?
Well, in the NFL, I think it's not even a contest. I don't think Steve Spurrier was being serious when he said that. I think he was trying to in his own way, take a little shot at certain people or tweak certain people, whether that was Nick Saban or whether that was the NFL coaching fraternity, where he did not succeed, and I think he did not feel welcome. I think that the worst NFL team, whether it's Kansas City or Jacksonville, would beat the best college team, let's say Alabama for the sake of this discussion, by 50 points. I think by the second half, it wouldn't even be a game. Frankly, it would be something where it wasn't even safe for the college players to be out there, because the physicality of the lines, both the offense and defensive lines, of the NFL teams, they would dominate early, and then it would become a complete mismatch. as the game wore on. So I, it's a game that should never be played because I don't think it would be safe for anybody involved, and I think it would be completely one-sided. The spread that R.J. Bell put on it was 24 points. And I, as Golic said on our show, and I would agree, I would give the points in the blink of an eye. I think it would be more like 50 or more.
Yeah.
In the case of basketball, I think last year was a fairly unique situation. And Jay Billis said it well on our show when we brought that up, talking about it, that Kentucky last year was that kind of uniquely good and the Bobcats last year were that kind of uniquely bad that it might be the one time or the one time out of every maybe 10 or 15 years that you might have a college team that could play with an NBA team. Generally speaking, college teams have gotten worse. When I was your age, college teams were made up of guys like Grant Hill and other players of his magnitude who played 4 years, and they played 4 years together. And, you know, the UNLV teams of my college age, with guys like Larry Johnson and Stacey Augman and Greg Anderson and Greg Anthony, excuse me, those guys played together for 3 years. In this day and age, every one of them would have gone to the NBA right after their first year. So if you took that Kentucky team from last year and you kept them together for 3 years, then I think they no doubt would have beaten some of the worst teams in the NBA. Being as they were just 1 year together and all freshmen, maybe they wouldn't. But in basketball, it's a sport where I think you could actually have a competition. In football, I don't think you ever should because I think it would be potentially dangerous to the college kid.
Absolutely. I mean, there are offensive linemen 320, 330, 340 pounds, and some college offensive linemen already in the 280s, 290s, 300 range. But I agree with you. Basketball, maybe, if a team stuck together long enough, it could happen. If there was a team to do it, it would probably have been Kentucky last year with the two first-round picks, Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. But even then,
it's tough. Actually, you know, how about North Carolina last year? I mean, North Carolina, if Kendall Marshall didn't break his hand in their second-round game, I think North Carolina would have been in the national championship game and would have made Kentucky have to work real hard to win that title. They had five players that were drafted this year. They had Tyler Zeller and John Henson up front. They had Harrison Barnes, who is, I think, going to be a star on the pro level. I think that they, too, could have given an NBA team, a really bad NBA team last year, to run for their money. Let's put it this way. I don't know that they weren't the best basketball team in the state of North Carolina last year, the Charlotte Bobcats included.
Right. Absolutely. Especially when you lose your point guard, the floor general and the leader on the court, it really sends the team in flux. Speaking of leaders on the field, that would transition me to the NFL, where we have seen a lot of surprises, Adrian Peterson being one of them, coming back from that horrific ACL injury. But to me, the biggest surprise of the season has been Peyton Manning, and this is a guy that people talked about as potentially not ever playing again as short as 10 or 12 months ago due to his neck injury. I mean, Manning leads the league in quarterback rating. He is completing 68.5% of his passes, 17 touchdowns to 4 interceptions, and only has taken 10 sacks. He's taken the least amount of sacks in the top 10 throwers in the NFL. What are some of your impressions about the Broncos and Peyton Manning?
Well, I think they're on their way to being the best team in the AFC. Let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling was that if they could just tread water through the very, very tough beginning of their schedule, then they would get better because he would get better, and then their schedule takes a marked turn towards the easier. And they did that. They treaded water. They found a way to win some of those early games. They beat Pittsburgh. They lost some of the games you figured they'd lose. They lost at New England. They lost to Houston. They lost at Atlanta. Those aren't bad losses. And they treaded water, and now Manning is playing at a ridiculously high level. Their division is just atrocious. They might wrap that thing up by Thanksgiving. And now you start talking about whether they can get the entire AFC to have to come through there to get to a Super Bowl. So I think they're in great shape. And as far as Peyton is concerned, you know, I'm 45 years old. I go back to the mid-1970s as a football fan. And in all of my life watching football, Peyton Manning is the best regular season quarterback I've ever seen. I would take him in the regular season. I would take him ahead of Joe Montana. I would take him ahead of Tom Brady. I would take him ahead of Brett Favre. I would take him ahead of the guys that I grew up watching, Terry Bradshaws and Roger Staubachs and guys like that. I would take him number one amongst any quarterback that I've ever seen play in the regular season. The only demerit, if you will, on Peyton has been that he has not always been as good in the playoffs as he's been in the regular season. And that's why I wouldn't say he's the best quarterback overall I've ever seen play. But in the regular season, he is, and that has just continued. So if you had told me he was going to be as close to healthy as he is, then I would have told you I'm not that surprised he's playing this well, because he's just that kind of good. I think the injury was the question mark, and I think he has clearly answered it. He's just been his usual unbelievably terrific self.
I agree with you. What I meant surprised was that he would come back to as close to 100% as we have ever seen him. It just stuns me. We all know Peyton, of course, his most valuable asset has always been his brain, his ability to dissect a defense, analyze coverages. He's phenomenal. I mean, I'm only 21. I don't nearly have the sports experience of you, but he is the best regular season quarterback I've ever seen. And I think that he's a guy people 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago will talk about as assuming he wins another Super Bowl. Maybe he's the greatest quarterback ever. Speaking of quarterbacks and volatile topics, Greeny, we all know you are a Jets fan. They're sitting 3-5 on the season. They have had their coach Rex Ryan flip-flop, saying he's not going to talk. Then he comes out and proclaims they're going to beat the Patriots. They played very well, but they lose, and then they get drummed by Miami. We all know with the addition of Tim Tebow, it's a lightning rod topic on top of the Jets, which are a lightning rod already. Is it time for Tebow, or are you one of these guys that are in the camp of Mark Sanchez gives us the best chance to win?
Well, I think that Mark Sanchez gives us the best chance to win is going to become irrelevant pretty soon, because there's no way in the world the Jets are going to win in Seattle. They have a bye week this week. Then they go to Seattle and St. Louis in consecutive weeks. If they go to Seattle and lose, which I would bet you everything I have that they will do, it's a tough place to play. It's a long trip. Seattle defense is really good. I don't think there's any way in the world the Jets win up there. And they go to 3-6. Then I think giving you the best chance to win every Sunday it ceases to be the reason that you do things. And what you start to consider is, what is the future going to be? And you ask yourself the question, is Mark Sanchez still the future of the Jets? And by that, I mean September of 2013. If the answer to that is yes, then you leave him out there. If the answer to that is no, then you can do any of a number of things, including play Greg McElroy, who was their third-string quarterback, who in the very limited amount of playing time he's had, all of it being preseason, has actually looked pretty good. And I know there are some people who kind of like him. Tim Tebow, in my opinion, is a player that you have to commit to 100%. The Jets clearly have not done that. They haven't even committed to him in a supporting role, much less making him the man. In order to commit to Tim Tebow, to make Tim Tebow your quarterback, you have to commit to it 100%. You have to build your team around him. I wouldn't be totally opposed to giving that a shot, but the Jets do not have the team to do that right now. They don't have the offensive line to do it. They don't have the depth of running back to do it. And if you're going to have Tim Tebow be your quarterback, you have to have a big, physical offensive line. They don't have that. You have to have multiple good running backs. They don't even have one. So there is no conceivable chance that they can do what Tim Tebow, they can succeed doing what Tim Tebow did last year in Denver. So to me, that's not even really an option. I do think it's possible that you can build a team around Tim Tebow if you are going to commit to it 100% and win. I think we saw that last year. But I don't think the Jets are going to do it. So to me, you can put Tebow out there just for the sake of getting some attention, which is what I think the owner is interested in, but you're not really committing to him because you're not giving him any chance to really succeed. So that would really be more of a show than it would be a legitimate effort to win. I think ultimately they will do it for that reason, but I don't think it'll get them anywhere.
you're right. The Jets do have some quarterback talent or some guys that potentially could be interesting. I know Peter King mentioned a couple weeks ago in his one of his articles, Greg McElroy might get a look before Tebow, and he was a national champion winning quarterback at Alabama. But I think the Jets almost have to go to Tebow at this point. What else did you bring him here for? Surely it was not, or I hope anyway, that it was not to be a punt protector and to just run two or three plays of Wildcat a game. He's too polarizing of a figure. People have too much, I would say, emotion maybe wrapped up in him. In a market like New York, it's very difficult to not spit in the face, but ignore what your fans want. It's there's too many teams, too much entertainment competing. It will be tough, but football is obviously the king. Do you think the Jets will draft a quarterback this season if they determine that it is not Sanchez or Tebow as the starter going forward?
I don't. I don't think so, because I don't think that their plan. I think that the people who are in place. Let me rephrase that. I think it'll depend on who gets fired, if anybody. If they fire the general manager, and if by some accident they fire the coach, and I say accident because I don't think that will happen at all. I do not in any way expect that to happen. But if they were to make those changes, then maybe. But as long as Rex Ryan is the coach, then I think they would stay in a win-now mode. I think he views them as a win-now team. Erroneously, but he does. And I don't think the owner is a real patient start-over kind of guy. So I think if they really determine that Sanchez is not the guy, that they will go out and sign a veteran. I have not sat down and looked at which guys might be available, but I think they will try and make a move to bring in a veteran quarterback. Just off the top of my head, you watch Matt Moore play against the Jets this past week for the Dolphins. And clearly Ryan Tannehill is the Dolphins' future. If Matt Moore were to become available, I think Matt Moore is a legitimate starting NFL quarterback, you know, who might be able to play. Let's see what happens in in Seattle. If Russell Wilson improves and is going to be the guy there long term, does a guy like Matt Flynn become available? Someone like that, the Jets might consider going in that direction. I would be very surprised. to see them decide they're going to draft a quarterback and give him the team and start over with that. But there's no one going to be available this year who's going to be Andrew Luck or RG3. I don't believe the guys who are coming out this year, the Barkleys, those kind of guys are considered to be on that level as prospects. So I do not think the Jets would go that way. I think if they do make a change of quarterback, it would be for a veteran.
Yeah, I think the only quarterback other than Barkley that may be highly considered a couple weeks ago anyway was Geno Smith. We had on my show Jason McKee, the former fullback for the Chicago Bears. He was very impressive, Geno Smith. Of course, that was before he had back-to-back losses or not great performances, I should say. One or two more here with Mike Greenberg. Mike, what do we think about the Dallas Cowboys? They play the Atlanta Falcons this week, obviously so-called America's team, one of the most popular franchises in the country. Tony Romo, he had a disastrous first quarter, came back to play well within a Dez Bryant fingertip or two of a comeback win for the second time against the Giants. Where do you see the Cowboys going forward? Is it this week make or break for them? Do you think they have a chance to go into Atlanta and beat the Falcons, who are undefeated? Or is that just too tall of a task considering where the Cowboys are?
I think they have a very good chance to win. Atlanta was very impressive last week against Philadelphia, but I think the Eagles are a complete mess. Atlanta was itching to get beat the 2 weeks before that, Oakland and Carolina. Both of those games were games they easily could have and probably should have lost. Atlanta's not going to go 16-0 by any means. I think the Cowboys have a real shot to go in there and beat them. And I think the Cowboys still have a shot to make something pretty special out of their season. If they don't, then I think that they should and will make a change at coach. I'm very unimpressed with how that team is coached. They make more ridiculous mistakes at the ends of games than any team I've ever seen. The situational football, the play calling at the end of their game against the Giants, I thought was abysmal. The way they handled the end of their game against Baltimore was ridiculous. I mean, they've had at least two games they've lost this year where they have soundly outplayed the team they were playing against and still managed to lose. If this season gets away from them, then I would not be surprised to see a change made. And I think that it is a real possibility that Jerry Jones will go after one of the really high-profile college coaches. A guy, just right at the top of my head, a guy like Nick Saban or Les Miles, someone like that, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see him try and go that route. And I think that a change would get made there. But that said, I still think they have a real chance to salvage something this season because I think they're good. I still believe in Romo, even though I know a lot of other people do not. And I think they have a real good chance to beat Atlanta this week.
I agree with you. I think Tony Romo is a it sounds interesting to say or ironic to say. I think he's very underrated. There are times he has implosions. But the Cowboys, they put a lot on him. And we saw a couple years ago when he broke his collarbone, they did not look great until John Kitna got him on track for a couple games at the end. But they did not look great. He has a huge burden placed on him. And to be very honest, not a lot of help from the offensive line and the receiving corps, which are physically gifted, but not maybe mentally the soundest or strongest players in the league. I think that game might come down to Julio Jones, Roddy White versus Brandon Carr and Morris Claiborne, the receivers versus the cornerbacks of the Falcons and Cowboys. If the Cowboys' coverage can hold up and let DeMarcus Ware and company get to Matt Ryan, the Cowboys should have a chance. Finally, Mike, the Pittsburgh Steelers will play the New York Giants this week. This is kind of an interesting matchup. Two Super Bowl quarterbacks, Ben Roethlisberger, Eli Manning, in the same draft class. Both teams have very good defenses. How do you see this one shaking up overall?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I'm living back here where I live, and I know you're from New Jersey. You know, the Giants have had a rough week. The weather did wreak a little bit of havoc, you know, as far west, obviously, as western Pennsylvania and Ohio, but nothing like what's happened in parts of New Jersey. I think that will have been a disruption for the Giants of some kind, and I don't know exactly what effect it will have on them, if any. So having said that, if there is an effect there, then maybe that tilts it. Other than that, I think it's a fascinating game because I love Roethlisberger. I think he's the most underappreciated great player in the sport, and obviously Eli is playing great. You know, it's anybody's game. I think the Steelers are ready to have a very good second half. The Giants have looked like a team ready to lose the game along the way here. So my gut feeling is that Pittsburgh wins, but it obviously could go either way. You know, we had Roethlisberger on our show this week, and he mentioned being in the same draft class with Eli, and that rather than having a competitive feeling with Eli now, that he feels more like he wants him and Eli and Phillip Rivers and Matt Schaub to try and make a run at being the greatest quarterback class ever. And, you know, I think the truth is they have a chance. The 83 draft, which had John Elway and Jim Kelly and Dan Marino in it, along with three other first-rounders, I think is generally considered to be the greatest of all time. And, this group is a long way from getting there, but I think they have a chance. They've already won twice as many Super Bowls as that group did. And I think that they have a real chance to win more. So I think that's one of the interesting subplots of the many interesting subplots in this game.
I absolutely agree. And one thing I guess you can always notice, the Giants have the pass rush between O.C. Umenyor, Jason Pierre-Paul, Justin Tuck, Matthias Kiwanuka. That is the ultimate equalizer in any game. That being said, maybe the only comp we can kind of see would be the Saints with Katrina in terms of having to move around. Obviously, the Giants are not at that point. But that's something to see. You know, that seemed to disrupt the Saints back a couple years ago. Hopefully for Giant fans it will not disrupt them. Cowboy fans, Eagle fans, Redskin fans, I'm sure, are hoping that Pittsburgh is able to come in here, knock off the Giants and get a win. I get the last thing which I meant to bring up, I would love to get your take on, would be the Eagles and the Saints. The Eagles are a team in turmoil. Michael Vick has turned the football over, and it almost seems like every time he drops back the pass. The Saints, obviously, with the bounty scandal, coming off the tough loss at Denver, where they just got completely demolished. The offense could not get rolling. The defense got lit up by Peyton Manning. Andy Reid came out this week, said Michael Vick will not be benched. He is the starter. But where does that leave the Eagles? Is this kind of the make-or-break game for them? If they lose this game, is the season completely over? Will Andy Reid be gone? Will we see a regime change? Or is that just hyperbole?
No, I don't think he'll get fired during the season, no matter what.
Right.
But I do think that if they don't make the playoffs, it will be time for a change. And in an honest moment, I think even he would tell you that was the right decision for the owner to make. I think Andy Reid will coach again in some other place as soon as next year if he wants to, if this thing goes down. But I think Reid and Vic are strapped together. You know, the reason to go to the rookie Nick Foles there would be because you feel like it's time to start looking at your future. But as I just said, if they don't make the playoffs this year, Andy Reid isn't going to be part of that future. So I think it's the right thing to do. As long as they still have a chance this season, you stay with Vic and you hope that you can still be what it is you thought when the season began you had a chance to be. And I don't know if they can or they can't. I will say this. If they can't do it against New Orleans, then they can't. Because the Saints defensively are about as bad as any team we've seen in the league in a really long time. So if they can't do it, and I actually think it is to the Eagles' benefit to be on the road this week with all the negativity swirling around their team. Getting away from home, it might be the best thing. Not might be, is the best thing for them. So I think they'll win. And I think that with a win, you keep things alive a little bit and you try and get a little momentum. And then the next thing you know, you win another game. And all of a sudden, you've got things turned around. So I think it is very possible that that will happen. But if they do not get it turned around, I think Andy Reid will coach out the season. Eventually, they would go to the rookie quarterback because there'd be no reason not to. And then I think someone else would be the coach of the Eagles next year.
I agree. I think that Vic and Reid are tied at the hip, whether they like it or not, meaning their futures, not a game-per-game basis, maybe later this season. Finally, Mike, has this just been a lost season for the Saints? The bounty scandal, the suspension of Sean Payton, the suspension of Joe Vitt, the two interim coaches, Jonathan Vilma fighting obviously, the bounty gate allegations. Has this just been overall lost season for the Saints?
Or yeah, absolutely. This is one of the very few things that I've ever predicted correctly. Before the season began, Golic was picking the Saints to win the division. They're going to make the playoffs. A lot of other people I knew were, and I said at the time, if the New Orleans Saints make the playoffs this year, that every coach in the NFL should walk into his owner's office and give back half his money. If the value of a head coach is so little that this team will still compete at the highest level, then everything I think I know about football is wrong. When you take the coach away, and I tweeted this in March when it was announced, I think that the punishments and the penalties were infinitely too harsh. I think that they absolutely demolished a football team, a franchise. They took away the chance to compete this year. And so I'm not at all surprised that it has gone as badly as it's gone. So, yes, I think it's a lost season, and I think that was easy to see coming. And next year when they regain their stability and, make a move or two here or there, I think they have a chance to go right back to where they were. But for right now, I think they're done, and I think they were done before the whole thing even began.
Mike, I would say, first of all, I agree with you with the Saints. I think they have too much talent in the future to be relegated to be a bad team. But this season, this is just kind of maybe wash your hands, walk away, come back next year and try to figure it out. But Mike, where, other than your Twitter account, which we can find at ESPN Greeny, where can my listeners find some of your work?
Well, that's obviously on ESPN, ESPN Radio, and on ESPN2 every day, and then the podcast, which is always available on ESPNRadio.com. I tweet at ESPN Greeny, and frankly, I think that's more than enough. Outside of that, I would think, even just listing those, I think I'm getting tired of me, and I would think that's more than enough for one person.
Mike, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
Because my younger brother, Douglas, graduated from Arizona State University in the mid-90s. I spent a lot of time there back then. I was there right after Phil Mickelson was there. And I have a lot of great memories of spending time at Arizona State. So let me ask you a few questions. Is Manzanita Hall still there?
Manzanita Hall is still there. They are currently renovating it, but it will be brand new next year. They did the top, top seven last year, bottom seven this year. Brand new floor next year.
That's where my brother lived his freshman year at Arizona State. Is a sports bar called McDuffie's still there?
Oh, that's a good question. Would that be on Mill?
That may be gone.
That might be gone.
It's 20 years ago, but we used to wake up on Sunday mornings when I would go visit him and go over there, and I used to love it. Now, you're an East Coast guy like myself. You know, those NFL kickoffs at 10 in the morning. What a pleasure. And we'd go over there, and we'd get wings and Bloody Marys and watch football all day. That was a lot of fun. There was a place called Flaky Jake's we used to go to that I remember was on campus or near campus. I had a lot of fun at Arizona State a long time ago. I used to always say I thought my brother had gone to college. It turns out he went to Club Med for 4 years. So that was a lot of fun. I hope everyone's having a good time there.
Yeah, Greeny, you know, we all love you here at Arizona State, obviously. I mean, I'm sure, you know, in between the tweets and the radio show, I'm sure you could probably figure that out. We really appreciate the time. So far, Arizona State, the football season has been, I would say, pleasantly surprising considering what was expected towards the end of last year. But as you know, as a sports fan, when you get results early and then they start to peter out later in the season, it is always difficult to swallow. But hopefully for your brother and Phil Mickelson and you yourself, of course, enjoy Arizona State athletics and the university and everything else. Mike, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
No, thanks, Mike. Be good. Into Second Down now. I would like to take another moment to thank Mike Greenberg of ESPN Radio's Mike and Mike in the Morning program. Greeny was very kind to give us a couple moments of his time today. In Second Down, I will discuss the Arizona State Sun Devils' defeat to the 19th-ranked Trojans of Southern California, 38-17. The Devils dropped to 5-5, 3-4 in the Pac-12. The Trojans advance to 7-3, 5-3 in conference. Before we break down the games, this is almost a fact off the bat. The Sun Devils' defeat to UCLA and to USC, two teams I thought the Devils had a chance to beat, that is just crippling their chances of winning the Pac-12 South to make it almost impossible. Whereas the Trojans advance and at points of the game looked very good. At other points, they did not. We'll start with the Trojans. Matt Barkley, 22 of 33, good for 222 yards, 3 touchdowns, but 3 interceptions. Not what you want to see from Matt Barkley. Not a Heisman-level game for the Trojan quarterback. He was averaging 6.7 yards per completion. His counterpart, Taylor Kelly, 19 of 30, 174 yards, 1 touchdown, 3 interceptions. We'll get to Kelly's performances later in the podcast. And Michael Eubank, 1 of 3, 5 yards, good for 1.7. Kelly, good for 5.8 a completion. But ultimately, that is the contrast of the game. Matt Barkley, with the 3 interceptions, ultimately led his team to make plays, in which Taylor Kelly did not. If we look at the stats, the Sun Devils, 15 first downs to the Trojans, 23 first downs. The Sun Devils, 6 of 16 on third downs. The Trojans, 7 of 16. So similar in terms of the conversions. The total yards, this is the big stat of the game. The Trojans, 447 total yards. The Sun Devils, 250. To be fair, Arizona State did have an interception return for a touchdown by free safety Alden Darby of 70 yards in the second quarter. But still, that is almost 200 yards more for the Trojans. That is unacceptable. Rushing, again, the Sun Devils, 71 rushing yards to the Trojans, 225. The Sun Devils, 35 rushing attempts. The Trojans, 43. This is the wow stat of the for the rushing performances. The Sun Devils averaging 2.0 yards per rush. The Trojans, 5.2. That is staggering. That is almost half a first down per rush. Penalties, again, ASU, 7 penalties for 49 yards. USC, 4 for 30 in turnovers. The Sun Devils won the turnover battle. 4 turnovers for the Sun Devils, 5 for the Trojans, including, like I said, that defensive touchdown by Alden Darby. But when push came to shove, ultimately, ASU was outclassed by a much more talented, much more polished team. Some of the highlights of the game: Curtis McNeil, 31 carries, 163 yards, 5.3 yards per carry, two touchdowns. Marquise Lee, the multi-talented and Heisman Trophy type wide receiver, also had six carries for 66 yards, a long of 38, averaging 11 yards per rush. For the Sun Devils, Cameron Marshall led the way for the backs, six carries, 37 yards, ran hard, 6.2 yards per carry, 14-yard long. Michael Eubank, the quarterback, 5 for 28. Marion Grice, 5 for 15. And this is disappointing for Arizona. Say DJ Foster, 3 carries, no yards. That is not encouraging. And you'll get the receiving totals for the Trojans. 10 receptions for 161 yards for Marquise Lee, including an 80-yarder. Also had a touchdown on the day. The Sun Devils led by Chris Coyle, 5 for 85 and a touchdown, long of 34. Maybe Coyle is starting to get his mojo or his jive back. For the Devils, they are going to need more help for the passing game. Rashard Ross, 2 catches, 31 yards. Marion Grice, 7 catches, 30 yards out of the backfield. Jamal Miles, 2 for 15. DJ Foster, 2 for 10. That is not good for the Sun Devils. That is not enough production from the backfield. That is not enough production receiving. The turnovers, like I said, we have to highlight Alvin Darby's 70-yard interception return for a touchdown, including Carl Bradford had a very nice interception, which was tipped. He was able to catch one of Matt Barkley's passes. But this is a discouraging loss for Arizona State. This was a game that was winnable in terms of you have Will Sutton back, you have Junior Onyeali back. The Sun Devils came out with a bang. Chris Coyle, 10 minutes into the first quarter, a 7-yard touchdown from Taylor Kelly. And then towards the end of the first quarter, the big mistake made by Arizona State. Marquise Lee, 80 yards from Matt Barkley. The Sun Devils recapped with the 70-yard interception turn from Darby in the second quarter, but then it was all Cal for the most part. A touchdown from Barkley. A run from McNeil. A field goal by Andre Hadard, the kicker, and a run from McNeil. There's nothing here that is encouraging if you're an Arizona State fan, for the exception of the fact that they were able to turn over Matt Barkley three times. Now, the question for Arizona State is, what can you do from here? To become bowl eligible should be the goal. Upcoming this week, Washington State, a game that Arizona State should win at home. If they do not win, that is frankly unacceptable. And then, of course, the rivalry game in Tucson against the Cats. Earlier in the season, I predicted ASU best case scenario would go 8-4. They are at 5-5 now with two games that are winnable, especially the Washington State game. Arizona State faithful must hope the Sun Devils can take care of business this week against Washington State, become bowl eligible, go to Tucson and play with the house's money in the rivalry game. If that does not happen, Arizona State is in trouble. Which brings me to third down, in which I'm going to look at Taylor Kelly, the sophomore quarterback from Idaho. In Arizona State's four losses, this was Kelly's passing yards. 93, 315, 153, 174. These are his touchdowns. 1, 4, 1, 1. His interceptions, this is critical, 2, 1, 1, 3. Now, do you say his best game against UCLA, 25 of 35, 315 yards, 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. That interception came at the end of the half, an interception that on a ball that should never have been thrown that directly led to points. 7 points on a Jonathan Franklin rushing touchdown, a play in which Kelly, under duress, just tried to throw the football away in the end zone, should have taken the sack, which would have only given up 2 points. The margin of defeat in that game, 2 points, UCLA 45, Arizona State 43. The defense did not help the Devils out that game. But still, Kelly made a mistake there. Oregon State, 153 yards, one touchdown, one interception. Not stellar numbers throwing the football, I would say, on a 53.7% completion percentage. What it was productive, however, was Kelly, 10 rushes for 80 yards. But UCLA, 19 of 30, 63.3%. One touchdown, three interceptions. And a game in which the defense gifted the Sun Devils 7 points on the interception return by Darby, the Devils' offense was only able to produce 10 points. And that includes two other interceptions. That is just unacceptable by the Arizona State Sun Devils. Taylor Kelly is a guy, as the quarterback, as the leader of the offense, he needs help from his backs. He needs more from his receivers. But you cannot throw three interceptions in the Coliseum and expect to beat a team coming off a loss against Oregon in which they scored 50-plus. You cannot expect to win against a Matt Barkley-led football team with Marquise Lee and Robert Woods, two absolute, no question, NFL first or second round picks in terms of speed, size, and athleticism. It's just not acceptable by the Arizona State quarterback. I still think Taylor Kelly gives the Sun Devils the best chance to win this week against Washington State and the following game against the Wildcats. But this is make or break time for the Sun Devils. If they want to go bowling, they need to get a win at home on Senior Day. This is where it gets done if you're Arizona State. This is where you have to draw the line in the sand, proverbially speaking, and say, we will not, a 2-8 Washington Cougar team who is 0-7 in the Pac-12, come in here and dominate. That is just not acceptable. The Cougars coming off a loss against UCLA, in which they lost 44-36, but that is not acceptable. It's not okay for Arizona State to lose this football game. They need this win desperately. And you know Mike Leach-led team is going to come out, and they're going to throw the football around. That is his MO. That's what he did at Texas Tech. This is a game I thought earlier in the season could be tricky for Arizona State if Washington State was able to get traction in the Pac-12 with the Mike Leach-led offense, which led to prolific passing attacks with the Graham Harrell, with Michael Crabtree at Texas Tech. But this is where the Sun Devil defense needs to make a stand. Sutton is back, Anyeli back. When players such as an Asahan Irabor, a Devaron Carr, an Alden Darby, a Chris Young need to make plays to allow Arizona State's offense to control the clock, to run the football, put some points on the board early, and step on the Cougars' throats. Which brings us to the matchup in this game between the Washington State Cougars and the Arizona State Sun Devils in Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe. The Cougars are sixth in the nation with 337.5 passing yards per game, 124th in the country, 32.9 rushing yards per game. They are 105th overall with 20.7 points per game scored by them, and they give up points against 33 points per game flat. That's 97th in the country. When you see those numbers, you say to yourself, the only thing that is really concerning for Arizona State would be those passing yards, 337.5 yards per game. But you know that with a Mike Leach offense, he likes to sling the football. And the Cougars have struggled. A loss of BYU, 30-6. A loss to Colorado, 35-34. A loss to Oregon, 51-26. Oregon State beat them 19-6. Cal beat them 31-17. Utah crushed them 49-6. Their closest game recently they have played was Stanford, 24-17. That's a loss. It is amazing to me this team got beat 49-6 by Utah. Comparatively speaking, the Devils beat Utah at home 37-7. There is no way the Sun Devils should lose this football game. Arizona State comes in 45th in the nation in passing yards, 261 on the button per game, 46th in rushing, 176 yards per game flat. And obviously, a balanced attack, rushing the football with a D.J. Foster, a Cameron Marshall, and a Marion Grice, the three-headed stable of backs, throwing the football with Taylor Kelly. The Sun Devils are a top 35 offense, scoring 35 points per game and holding teams to 24.7 points per game, making them the 47th overall defense in the country. Arizona State has at times looked very dominant and at times looked very vulnerable. In this four-game losing streak, Oregon 43-21. Oregon called the dogs off. That could have been worse. UCLA should have been a victory, 45-43. Still no Will Sutton. Oregon State, the Devils came out on fire. Very aggressive. Had a nice lead against the Beavers, and Oregon State able to come back. And USC, a 7-0 lead. The defense scores a touchdown, but just too much talent. This is a game, like I said, the Sun Devils need to win if they want to go bowling. When you look at the Cougars, you go a little bit in-depth. The Cougars quarterback Jeff Toole is 170 for 263, good for 1,670 yards per game. That's 65% completion percentage. He has 8 touchdowns, 5 interceptions. Toole has not played as many games as Cougar fans would have hoped. Connor Holiday has had to step in due to Toole being injured. He will be back this week. The Cougars' rushing attack is spearheaded by two running backs, T'Andre Caldwell, 50 carries, 249 yards, averaging 5 yards a pop, and Carl Winston, 66 carries for 214 yards and 2 touchdowns. Receiving for the Cougars, lead wide receiver Marquise Wilson had 52 catches, 813 yards, 5 touchdowns, a long of 81. Wilson, an NFL-type wide receiver, a lot of hopes up in Pullman about whether or not Toole and Wilson could connect. Marquise Wilson is a fantastic receiver, which would have given Asahani Arabor and Devron Clark troubles. Interesting key to note, which helps the Sun Devils defensively. Wilson has quit the team coming off the loss to Utah a couple weeks ago. Wilson accused Mike Leach of, quote, physical, emotional, and verbal abuse. When you hear that about Mike Leach, a guy fired from Texas Tech for apparently abusing a player, locking him in a closet, actually son of former ESPN analyst and SMU and New England Patriot running back Craig James, Adam James, the tight end. You hear that about Mike Leach and you think, does Mike Leach even get it? We're not here to debate or analyze whether Mike Leach gets it, but to break down the game on the field. And Marquise Wilson, a huge clog for that Washington State offense, has been eradicated from the equation. Conversely, Gabe Marks is the next leading receiver, 44 catches, 528 yards, 2 touchdowns. More of a possession guy, averaging about 12 yards per reception. More of a possession type guy. Isaiah Myers, the next leading receiver, 37 catches, 380 yards, 4 touchdowns. And Brett Bartoloni, 46 catches, 360 yards, 4 touchdowns on the season. 3 receivers to maybe keep an eye on. I would keep an eye on this kid, Dominique Williams, 23 receptions, 351 yards, averaging 15.3 yards per reception. He's a long of 43 and 3 touchdowns. Clearly a guy that can stretch the field a little bit. But Arizona State, the equation is simple. You need the pass rush from Sutton. You need to run the football, put points on the board. The Cougars have shown against Utah and against other opponents that they will crumble if you do not let them stay around. It is critical for Arizona State to put them away. If the Sun Devils do not, if Taylor Kelly does not play well, if the defense does not get the pass rush with Sutton and Bradford and Young and McGee, you will put increased responsibility on Erebor and Carr to cover. And these are receivers that are not dynamic, and they can do that. But you do not want Washington State hanging around. That is not what Arizona State needs. Frankly, this should not be the kind of game in which ASU looks at itself and says, we let this one get away. That would be unacceptable. UCLA last week against Washington State was up 37-7 at the half. You would have thought that would be enough. It was enough points. They scored another touchdown in the third quarter. But Washington State finished up with 14-15 in the third and fourth quarter. UCLA, you know, was putting it on them, but did not let them hang around a little bit. Maybe took the pedal off the gas. So it is critical for ASU to come out on fire and get the job done for all fans in Arizona State. That being said, if the Devils do not do that, that puts all the emphasis on the game in Tucson against Rich Rodriguez and the Wildcats, which I'm sure, as Wildcat and Sun Devil fans alike know, 2 years ago, ASU goes down. James Brooks blocks the field goals. Zendejas, the kicker at the time for the Cats, misses a couple field goals. And next thing you know, the Sun Devils pull off an upset in Tucson, a huge win for the program. Last year, Arizona State needs a win in the worst way against the Wildcats. The Dennis Erickson-led Sun Devils unable to get the job done. The Cats upset. So you know anything could happen. I mean, the Wildcats last year were a dead team walking, so to say. And Arizona State did not do the job, and the Cats come in and get the win. So this is critical for Arizona State to take care of Washington State early, put them away, and move on. Which brings me to fourth down. Speaking of teams that have been put away as we transition from Arizona State University football to the NFL, I would like to talk about something that has been bothering me, and Mike Greenberg and I discussed it earlier, the quarterback situation for the New York Jets. Rex Ryan comes out this week and says Mark Sanchez is his quarterback again. The Jets come off a 28-7 drumming of the Seattle Seahawks in which they scored a defensive touchdown. That means that the offense scored no points as we deduct the 7 defensive points away from their total score to get 28-0 if you took out the defensive points. They comes off scoring 9 against Miami, losing in overtime to New England, which they scored 26. But this is ultimately my point. At what point do the New York Jets say to themselves, the Mark Sanchez experience is not working? Now, to be fair, Sanchez has 153 completions out of 294 attempts. That's good for 52%. He has 1,860 yards. He has 10 touchdowns, 9 interceptions, taken 21 sacks, has a quarterback rating of 70.4. That's not good. Sanchez may look better in practice. And even if we assume what Rex Ryan says, Sanchez gives the Jets the better chance to win. I would argue to Rex Ryan and Mike Tannenbaum, the GM of the Jets, I would argue, at what point do we say, even though Sanchez gives us the, quote, best chance to win, do we put Tim Tebow in? Because sitting where the Jets are sitting now, it makes you wonder, what point do we go to Tim Tebow? What did they trade him for? If you look at the Jets' upcoming schedule, they have at St. Louis, home against New England, home against Arizona, at Jacksonville, at Tennessee, home against San Diego, at Buffalo. They have 7 games left. They're 3-6. We know they're going to lose to New England. That puts them at 3-7. They're probably going to lose to St. Louis, who just took the 49ers to the mat. That's 3-8. Even if they win their next 5 games, at 8-8, that's not good enough to make the playoffs this season. So at what point do we go to Tim Tebow? The Jets did not bring Tim Tebow in here to be a personal protector. And we've all heard the Jets don't have the offensive weapons on the outside. Jeremy Curley doesn't scare anybody. Stephen Hill, the rookie out of Georgia Tech, has raw ability, but that's the key phrase, he's raw. At what point do we go to him? Sean Green, as Robin Lundberg discussed earlier, is starting to run harder, but Bilal Powell isn't doing anything for anybody. The only explosive, quote-unquote explosive back they have is Joe McKnight. They don't give him the football. What point do the Jets go to Tim Tebow? And if they don't go to Tim Tebow, what did you get him for? That's the question the Jets have to ask themselves every day. Because they've invited a circus into their house for no reason. There makes no sense to bring Tim Tebow in and not play him. You wanted to try the Mark Sanchez way. I understand they gave Sanchez an extension. They paid him money. He did the Jets West thing, but at what point do you play him? And then you have the Jets defensive players coming out anonymously saying, and I quote, he's terrible. Another Jet saying, expletive, no, he's the wildcat guy. He's not a quarterback. At what point do we sit there and say to ourselves, if Mark Sanchez gives the Jets the best chance to win and we're sitting at 3-6 as the New York Jets and New York Jet fans are, how much worse could Tebow be? How much worse? The Broncos last year were at a losing record with Kyle Orton, who gave him a better chance to win, in parentheses. And at what point do we sit there and say, just like John Elway and the Broncos did, how much worse can it get? Because the Jets look ridiculous, trading for this guy, bringing him in, and at the end of the day, not using him. It doesn't make any sense. You can find a lot of guys out there, as we discussed with Jason McKee earlier in the show, a guy like Armani Edwards. There's a lot of college quarterbacks out there. The Patriots found one in Julian Edelman that could run a Wildcat offense if you wanted. It doesn't make any sense to bring in the Heisman Trophy, 2-time national champion, most polarizing quarterback in sports, to bring him in to block punts, or to protect against block punts, I should say, and to throw the football on a fake field goal and a fake punt. It doesn't make any sense. The Jets need to bring Tebow in. Like Robin Lundberg says, need to see what we have in Tebow. And frankly, if I'm a Jet fan, I'm furious that we don't know what we have. And I'm furious that our vaunted defense is not vaunted anymore. I'm furious we give up 28 to Seattle, 30 to Miami. That's unacceptable. Unacceptable. And we got shut out against San Francisco earlier in the season. I mean, how good could Sanchez be in which a game against San Francisco, he threw for 103 yards. The win against Indianapolis, he threw for 82. Granted, Sean Green went off for 161 rushing yards, but 82. How much worse could it possibly get? How much more inaccurate or more unproductive could Tim Tebow be? That's all the question I'm asking. I'm not a Jet fan. I don't have a dog in that fight. But to blame Tim Tebow for the problems of the Jets, I find is irresponsible. Which brings us to Fifth Down, in which I can remind all of you, you can get in touch with the show by tweeting me at Fifth Down Mike or emailing the show at fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. You can also find the show on iTunes. If you go to the iTunes music store, you search Fifth Down, or you search my name, Michael Faiella, F-A-I-L-L-A, in the iTunes music store, you will find the Fifth Down podcast. This is the mailbag segment of the show in which we answer emailers' questions, which is where I got this question from Marissa in Old Bridge, New Jersey. Marissa wants to know, what does the Sun Devil loss to Oregon, UCLA, and Oregon State mean for the Sun Devils for the rest of the season? And Marissa, clearly the Sun Devils need a win against Washington State to save the season. And when I mean save it, I mean go to a bowl in Todd Graham's first year, at least, you know, get a winning record, beat the Cougars, beat the Wildcats, go to a bowl game. It's the house's money. You have to feel good about it. If the Sun Devils do not accomplish that, I think this would have been, considering where they were, the excitement after the Utah win, the excitement after the Illinois win, the way the offense clicked, the way true freshman DJ Foster, junior college transfer Marion Grice and Cameron Marshall played, the way the defense was tenacious, and the way Will Sutton looked like he was maybe the defensive player in the year in not only just the Pac-12, but maybe even the NCAA. If the Sun Devils don't go bowling, it is very, very disappointing for all Sun Devil players and fans. So that this game is increased importance. ASU needs a win for their morale and really for the fan base. Without that, this may have been a lost season. And with that, I'd like to wrap up the show. Tell you all, thank you for downloading us. Remember, you could find us in the iTunes music store. Search Michael Faiella or the Fifth Down Podcast. Tweet me at Fifth Down Mike and send your emails in to fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. And with that, thanks for downloading us.